The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guests on Off the Shelf are Bill Gormley. Bill is the president of the Gormley Group. He's also the chairman of the Coalition Board of Directors. And also my other guest today, and we're doing a procurement tag team event here with one Tom Sisti. Tom is Senior Director and Chief Legislative Counsel at SAP. Tom is also a member of the Coalition Board. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Roger.
Pleasure to be here.
Roger,
I'm trying to understand. So I have two lawyers against an operational person here. So I'm just trying to.
So you have the advantage.
If I lag in my, you know, just sir, whatever. Yeah, yeah. Okay. All right.
Well, today we're going to talk about a little bit about just the state of procurement, just the way things work, and a little bit about the nexus between procurement policy and procurement operations, how they impact each other, unintended consequences, frameworks, alternatives, how do you have a system that addresses the non-binary nature of the commercial marketplace? And so first, let's talk about, because it's one thing that I know the 809 panel is focused a lot on, is, you know, the role of, for example, multiple award IDIQ contracts. And first, you know, Bill, what are, you know, there are multiple award IDIQ contracts authorized by FASA, Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act of 1994. So they've been around 23 years. And then the GSA Schedules Program is another statutory authority for a multiple award contract. You like all this lawyer stuff there,
yeah,
Bill?
Yeah, I'm pretty impressed. It's pretty good.
Okay, good. those are the two chief kinds of multiple award contracts out there, IDIQs. What is the, from your perspective, the purpose of those contracts? How do they fit into the system?
Well, can we kind of talk a little bit before that and just to kind of lay the foundation, if you don't mind?
Okay, that's good.
So I think part of the 809, the intent is like anything else. It's for the right reasons. It's, you know, how can government do better just overall? In this case, it's in the area of acquisition. And I think one of their objectives is to just streamline it to the point where acquisition is primarily focused on, they call it the big A, whether it's planes, tanks, and ships, and otherwise is acquired by another means to meet the warfighter. So, but to you know, that's kind of a big statement and a big objective.
Yes.
And so I was talking to some folks recently, not about 809, but it ends up tying into it, about the FAR and how, you know, sometimes when something is good, it can be abused a lot, right?
Sure.
And the FAR, and they brought it up, is that the FAR is kind of the gold standard in acquisition, which you don't, you just don't hear, you know. I'm like, are you serious? The FAR. And so, but the world looks at that body of acquisition, policies and approaches, guidance, and methodologies, yeah, right? As there's rationale behind it. And as a former contracting officer and a manager, you know, I always used the FAR. I mean, its intended purpose is guidelines, and you make business decisions and discussions. And I think my personal opinion is, if we've moved away from that and we just become more critical of the umbrella term, the government acquisition environment is high hurdles.
Right. Tom, do you think that's, he's talking about the guidance versus process. Have we become so process orientated that we've actually lost lost perspective of the value of the FAR and how flexible parts of it are?
We seem to be in a compliance-rich environment where people look at procedure and try and reduce it as much as they can to check in the box so that they know if I'm in this path, I'm not going to have a problem, be it internally from a management standpoint, be it from an oversight standpoint. That's the challenge that they face.
Sort of regardless of the ultimate outcome, right? As long as you follow the process.
Well, I'm not going to their intent. I'm just saying that you've got – that's what our environment is. And it doesn't help, I think, when you start generating rule after rule after rule, because you increase the level of compliance activity and then you pull away from the performance activity. I think when you talk about multiple award contracts, you have to consider why they exist in the first place. Those contracts came about years ago in the context of the reform effort because there was a response to a marketplace that required quicker action, the ability to access the vehicles to make those purchases. You know, we can't make a purchase without a vehicle. And so having a multiple award contract allowed the government to, it kind of merged the multiple award nature of contracting with the indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity flexibility that existed under traditional IDIQs, permitted the government to respond to the needs of its customers in a dynamic market. And we're probably hitting an inflection point again, requiring a relook at those things.
Right. Well, when you say a relook, when we are in it, so I guess we are at an inflection point because you got the 809 panel who's looking at all things DoD acquisition, multiple board contracts. You have, you know, rapid changes in the commercial marketplace, the way things are acquired, business to business even, and also just the public, the way it buys. So how do... Yeah, what do you think? You know, how do multiple board contracts stay relevant, or are they still relevant?
Well, I think the you mentioned 809. We touched on that, but you also have 801, who's looking at the e-commerce.
Yeah, that's Section 801 of the House and National Defense Authorization Act, which is would create a commercial marketplace.
Well,
online platform from a commercial marketplace.
That's why the audience is happy they got two lawyers here.
Yeah, right. To correct, yes.
So anyway,
someone needs to correct me. Both of you can do that.
So 801 is basically e-commerce, okay? And I think the consideration there is, you know, how does the government's needs for what it takes to run the government, how are those needs met in the e-commerce environment, as an example, or just what, as Tom touched on, the changes in from an industry standpoint, the velocity of business. And I think we get caught up in that. And from the standpoint is that we, the government, and I guess the taxpayers would feel the same way. We want to be a part of it so we're not lost. And I think when the government goes back to, well, we got to follow our regulations, you know, this is taxpayer money. This is not sexy, all right? And I think that's where a lot of people... You know, like, oh my God, I got to deal with the government. And some of that is for, you know, fiduciary reasons and how we spend money. And, you know, in some cases it's not spent very well. And other reasons it's not spent well with the intent to defraud the government. So I think we understand the need for compliance and those offices for oversight. I think Tom was touching on a point where I think it's almost a gotcha environment from a contracting officer's if a third party looks at what's been done and they haven't, from a third party's objective, which is easy to provide an opinion after a decision's made, as we all know. So I think part of this discussion earlier was they take the path of least resistance. And I think sometimes the government doesn't take advantage of that as much. And I think that's, again, people talk about, hey, we're going to make a mistake once in a while in government. Don't worry about it. You know, that just means we're moving forward and we're going to get better. And I think we don't hear enough of that, or we don't see enough of those examples of where the government's better off today. And I think it takes the 809 and 801 type initiatives to shake the government up and say, hey, how we're doing business today, is that how we should be doing it moving forward?
Right. That's the question. What is, I mean, ultimately, the purpose of the procurement system is to support customer agency missions and, you know, to ultimately serve the American people, right? How do we best do that? Or what's, you know, in that context and in all the other contexts and pieces, the non-binary world we live in, how does all that work? So you guys still haven't sort of answered my question, so we're going to have to save it till the next segment. Are multiple ward IQs relevant? What are their purpose? And, you know, ultimately, if there's problems with them, what are the fixes, given the context of the FAR and how Bill thinks that's the gold standard for procurement out there? My guest, and we'll talk about all those things in the next segment. My guests today are Bill Gormley. He is the chairman of the Gormley Group. And Tom Sisti, he is senior director and chief legislative counsel at SAP. And you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Tom Sisti. He is a senior director and chief legislative counsel at SAP. And Bill Gormley, who is the president of the Gormley Group. Gentlemen, the first segment, you know, I tried to get you to talk really about multiple ward IDIQs, and you wouldn't have it. You wanted to talk about all the background stuff. So let's start out. And
your binary phrase through me, right. So I'm trying to understand.
Okay, yes. Non-binary or binary?
Yeah.
Well, okay, so.
Well,
Tom, multiple ward IDIQs, are they relevant?
Well, it's interesting because you're talking about a non-binary procurement environment and you asked a binary question.
Tom. That's very good. I wondered if somebody would pick up on that. That's very good. He must be the lawyer, Bill.
One of them.
Right? you have to go back and, again, look at why those were put in place. We said earlier on that it was felt that the government needed to adapt to the marketplace, needed to have an access to it, needed the flexibility of contracting. So, does it not need those? You know, is your first question. The second question is, okay, if we agree that they need them, then is this the best vehicle? If not, why? And if the reason they're not the best vehicle is because there's stochastic management of those vehicles, you know, then you have to ask, well, where's that coming from? So many times people say, well, you have this proliferation, we don't know what we're buying. We have all this undue duplication of contracting. Okay, well, you don't get those contracts without, say, like an IT, without a Form 300. You don't, you know, somebody approved them through the system. So maybe your control system is the problem. And before you start, you know, cutting off vehicles to the agencies that have to operate, you ought to make sure that there's not a breakdown in the system elsewhere. I think the danger in aggressively reforming is that you throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. You have you come with a presumption that there's one way to do it, and you don't look at this from the standpoint, as you mentioned earlier, of the mission of government procurement, which is to facilitate the fulfillment of agency missions. What does the agency need? Do they need one thing, or do they need different tools for different circumstances?
Right, and flexibility. Right?
Yes, exactly, flexibility. And the other thing, and Bill mentioned this, is that we're talking about taxpayer money. You know, you go back to the reforms of the 90s, it would have been very easy to say the government must buy commercial. The law doesn't say that. It says must buy commercial to the maximum extent practicable. And there was a long discussion over that, the reason being that the government isn't a commercial enterprise. It has certainly inherently governmental functions that have to be performed. It has to manage data. It has to manage national defense. These are issues that, you know, conveniently aren't in necessarily the private sector when they are running their organizations and answering to shareholders.
Right, Bill?
Well, so I guess commercial buys from commercial, right? That makes sense. And the government buys to commercial as much as practicable. So I'm trying to, you know, I think as far as, Roger, your initial question of, should the government change its type of contracting vehicle or vehicles? So I don't know if we're looking for a new flavor, you know, in the social media realm, so to speak. So maybe e-commerce is
contracting by Twitter, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, I had by Wynn.
Okay.
But anyway, I didn't know what it meant, so I just I wasn't going to bring it up. But anyway, okay. But the it just shows you that I think the government has enough tools. Okay, and you know, you mentioned a toolbox. I think they have enough tools in there. I think they could do a better job of just. I think the government would be significantly more productive and efficient by just really, you know, either refurbishing, making, you know, the reduction of red tape, you know, the old term we all love to hear, but we don't really see it, you know, and reducing a lot of the burden on its industry suppliers. Some of it is for financial reasons or taxpayers, but there's a lot that's not. And I think that's keeping that to a minimum, I think, would enhance competition on the contracting side, just that alone, because it's the entry to government market now is just getting higher and higher, and I think that's part of a.
Well, some would say the multi-board IDIQ concept is actually creating those barriers, because you get on the contract, you have it, you're in the pool, and there's not an opportunity to compete to get on it. You know, I mean, schedules is different, right? Because schedules have except for Schedule 75, which the office applies. Schedules have continuous open seasons.
Hopefully
but other multiple
board,
that's one of the sort of observations you hear about multiple board contracts.
Well, but part of the intent was even on the schedules, they I think it would be good for the government to look at this. You know, can we talk acronyms here?
Sure. Why not? We're doing a government show.
Like a CSP.
I mean, CSP, commercial sales practices format.
We said GSA, so I could say CSP now. Anyway.
Well, now you're making me get the willies when you start talking about
that. But anyway, I think the way that the government's looking for how they determine fair and reasonableness in award to make a contract or have to have some form of consideration to have a contract. I think the CSP could be looked at because the speed of commercial business is changed significantly since the CSP, was brought about based on the DSMD.
Right, man, you're really going back. Discount.
I'm sorry.
Schedule marketing data.
People are going to start turning the show down here.
They're going to turn it off, right?
Now we got to get relevant and talk about e-commerce. But anyway, I think finally acknowledging it, and the government's not giving anything away. They're getting closer to what they want to get to. And I think trying to preserve or have a risk avoidance, tendency of how one works just minimizes your opportunity. I think the government, they have the 809. There's a lot of discussion. Hey, we want to blow up, so to speak. I use the term, but blow up the DoD acquisition platform. You know, I'm going to tell you, when all the pieces come down, you're still going to have the same industry. You're still going to have the same government need. So how do we get each other closer together and on a competitive basis and go into best value? And you've heard me say this before, Roger, but I'm going to say it now because, no one gets the lowest price on anything. And I know that's hard for us to just get in our heads.
Well,
but
what do you mean?
The
government's the biggest buyer.
That's relative. Okay. And so I'd say the majority, of fighters and ships and tanks, no question. On your consumables and commercial type services, I'd say no.
Okay. Is it also the biggest delivery point, set of delivery points? The government's not. It's not like the government's sending one order out,
right,
and one order's coming back in to one location at a fixed point in time. It's much different. You know, this is where you almost cringe because some of the stuff is self-inflicted.
Yep.
I mean, you're given the tool to utilize commercial practices, for instance, like, hey, you can rely on commercial terms and conditions. And then you go out of your way yourself to change the order of precedence in terms of contract clauses so that commercial terms and conditions are reduced or lowered to right above the signature line.
Government terms control in 99.9%.
Right. So what did you do? You basically implicitly undermined the intent of the statute, if not explicitly. You know, this is the problem. You have these institutional factors that I don't care how many, if you give somebody a hammer to build a house and they smack themselves in the head, I mean, do you blame the hammer? Or, do you...
That's a great Is that an analogy? What is that?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, so I'm learning.
You drinking today or what?
Cut it out. Yeah, I'm water. So it sounds like you guys are sort of on the view that your management practices need to be improved, like acquisition practices need to be improved. More fun, and that's the bigger challenge rather than, you know, the FAR whatever. Yeah.
I think to your point, just kind of summarize, or if we're going to stay on this for the rest of the show, it's fine. If not, I think it's a human factor. I think it, you know, we have to get that better management within the acquisition community. And that's not to offend anyone. It's just along with better management comes the fact that, you know, how are we going to practice when someone does make a mistake, you know, and yet we don't really hear about all the great stuff that goes on as well. So I think and that's a continuous, you know, messaging, you know, throughout government. So, you know, personally, I think the government has the tools. They just need to get the management, you know, arena improved and allow the contracting officers and the other folks that provide. Oh, now, wait a minute. Now, this is just a thought came across my mind. So it's the contracting officer, right? Everybody talks about the contract. If it wasn't for the contracting officer. But you know what? Contracting officer has other services that are available to them in many cases. And we can, yeah, we can have the audit side in some cases. But we also have lawyers. We also have legal people within the government. And, you know, sometimes those folks may be risk averse from their legal perspective. And where they're supposed to be advisors, not give a firm opinion of the agency, and the contracting officer then is going to have to fight internally. Those are nuances here, and we can kind of joke about them, but those are real, significantly right. Real. We've been, you know, through the coalition trying to get ODCs forever, and everybody says it's a good idea. I mean, it's like a customer and industry is a three-legged stool: customer, industry, and GSA. The customer and industry want it badly. GSA just can't pull the trigger, and they rename it. So that's a self-inflicted hurdle or burden or risk, however you want to categorize it, and that stunts the growth of the program, the usage, and creates other workload.
Right. Or ODCs are it's.
Excuse me, that was an acronym.
Yeah, yeah. ODCs, other direct costs. GSA renamed it Order 11 Materials, and that would be a way to improve one of the tools in the toolbox, right? So, but we do have to come up. We are at the break. Guys, my guests there, Bill Gormley, he is president of the Gormley Group, and Tom Sisti, he's senior director and chief legislative counsel at SAP. And, you know, we just concluded this segment talking about improving management and the human factor. Well, let's talk about management, category management, and what you see for the future of it. And what the impact has been to date. Again, you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Tom Sisti, he is Senior Director and Chief Legislative Counsel at SAP, and Bill Gormley. Bill is President of the Gormley Group. Gentlemen, we finished up the last segment talking a little bit about touching on management and the importance of it. So I wanted to talk this segment. It was on my list to discuss with you, and that is category management. Management or organizational structures, category management, philosophically, it's something that the government, and particularly GSA, has spent a great deal of energy and time over the last 4 years attempting to implement, whether it's, you know, organization of FAS, its systems, its focus on its acquisition vehicles, you know, transactional data reporting, all these things. And then there's government-wide category management sort of orchestrated from OMB and OFPP. And just your sense of where is it going and where, well, first, maybe where's it been in terms of what the practical impact of it has been, and then where do you think it's going?
Well, I think the intent of category management is kind of picked up from commercial practice, you know, and Tom's talked about, you know, from an industry standpoint, and industry is driven to be as successful as it can. It doesn't say that industry makes all their decisions are correct. And I heard for the first time recently, and it was pretty interesting, that if for the first time in the history of our country, more companies went out of business than started. Now, that was kind of, so obviously it says industry does not make a lot of good decisions either. So there's more on the small business side. But it's kind of an interesting data point. So I think when you get into category management, being a commercial practice, it's basically organizing yourself, and the government has around these category management leadership councils, and they put a head in charge of them. There's like, I think, was there 10 councils?
10 categories.
Know, 10 categories, excuse me, which would, I guess, mean councils too, but chairs. And so they're looking at, you know, either bringing together, you know, IT is always, and people always want to talk about that, or professional services or security and office management. There's 10 of them, and trying to figure out how does the government harness its requirements or its needs for those categories to get a better deal. And I think it's well intended. The government, the way it's organized, it's built to be fragmented, and that's right. I'm not trying to be. I'm just saying, you know, there's reasons for it. I'm assuming through Congress. Congress has their own swim lane, so to speak, their own responsibilities, their own committees they're on. So some of those committees could really work with other committees, and I would say they try to do that. But as a result, each year, at some point during the course of a year, they get a budget for that entity or for that agency or department. And that department is going to run off that budget. And for those who've been in the military or, you know, ship's captain or someone who runs a hospital at VA, they have the ultimate responsibility of spending that money to meet their mission. And it's not that they don't care about the rest of the government. They just don't have time to figure it out. You know, they got patients they're trying to take care of, or they're trying to FEMA right now. You know, you think FEMA's focused on the highest objective of that agency. Right now, they probably are more so than anything. But if you look at the procurement side, are they looking at how many contracts can we put out there? They are, to a point of they meet the needs of the citizenship right now. And so some people will come back just by history, and the IG will go in there and say, you know, you could have done a better job here. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, they're taking care of the person who needs the water or who needs the blankets or who needs. So the government has to have the ability to respond. And when we do respond, and I think in many cases the right way, the government still has the oversight to come in and like they want to come in and look at it, and they want, and it should be that we want to get better, but it shouldn't be from a critical standpoint. It should be, hey, you know, these are tough times. We just went through two huge storms in Texas and Florida, and then also, you know, the islands and Puerto Rico. So people just can't sit back and be Monday quarterback. By the way, the Redskins won yesterday. So, but being a Monday quarterback and trying to figure out how could we have done it better. It's just the human nature, Roger. So some of this is not built in, but category management is a good way to identify the attempt of harnessing the government's needs. I think it's going to cost the government more than they're going to get out of it.
Right. I think you touched on one thing through that, Bill, and that is, I think the unintended sort of stovepiping, I think, potentially, of category management as markets become more integrated, right? Yeah. On the commercial side, it's really an interesting, you know, problem or challenge for the acquisition system, because at the same time the commercial markets gets more integrated, like why have a distinction between professional services and IT professional services, mm-hmm. for example. But the flip side is that, you know, the entities within government, as much as they want to, quote, buy as one, they have different missions, different funding profiles. As you mentioned earlier, many, many different delivery points, Tom, right? There's all kinds of unique aspects of government agencies that I think they've been there as long as government existed, and they're not going to go away merely because you come up with category management. So how you got that market that's becoming more and more integrated or cross sort of functional, and agencies that have their unique missions, and you're the bridge between the two. That's a big challenge. And category management, it was an effort to try to address that, I think, but yeah, I'm not sure.
I know Tom's going to want to grab the mic here, so can I just have one quick point here?
Yeah, sure.
Everything you say. Personal experience, and this is not a criticism, just actual experience about that the fragmentation. DOD has transportation as a category manager. Years ago, when I was at GSA, DOD has their transportation program. The civilian agencies tried to get in and use it. DOD had said, we have our mission, and maybe this has changed. I doubt it, because DOD is here there
it's
for
DOD.
A reason. Right. But they couldn't get in, and so we at GSA created those services under the schedules program. Now that's been frozen to go back to DOD. So this is going to be an interesting, I'm just right. giving you one.
That's a great
one,
example, because even that's example. A bureaucratic
yeah.
sort of,
I mean,
because
so
DOD, doesn't have DOD doesn't have government-wide authority to provide overnight delivery services to civilian agencies, and I'll let Tom talk in a second. But they don't have that authority, so GSA delegate. GSA has the contracts and the authority, and the irony is they've dealt under pursuant to category management. Yeah. They've delegated authority to DOD for the overnight delivery contracts. On the surface, people who know this, it doesn't make any sense. Tom,
it's a balance between process and mission, and if you're not focusing on the mission, you're diverting energies and resources to the process, and you're putting the people who have to execute in these programs in a very difficult spot, because they have responsibility to fulfill a mission, and they cannot fulfill that mission because they are responding to a process change
as opposed to trying to meet the mission.
Mm.
Right. So, you know, that's interesting. I mean, and one could say one of the unintended consequences of category management is it's very process driven in a process driven environment, right? And think of just best in class contracts. That whole concept is a very processed. I mean, to me, it makes absolutely no sense, business sense. This idea that the government's going to identify best in class contracts, and people have to use those.
Well, you get into a nomenclature problem, because best in class might mean one thing in the private sector. Best in class, at least under the draft memo that was circulated, meant compliance with the process. And that's the very problem we're talking about, is the process becomes the end point. It doesn't become the tool to be used to fulfill the goal, which is facilitating agency mission performance.
Right, the best in class, to your point, the best in class talked about process. It never talked about outcomes in terms of the criteria for identifying.
And all of these things, whatever you're doing, you have to have baseline metrics to understand where you are, and you have to have output metrics to understand the value you achieved, if any. If you don't have those, then how do you determine whether or not you're performing well?
Right. And Bill, I'm going to ask you a lawyer's question. So this is an interesting dynamic. So best-in-class contracts were outlined in the draft OMB circular on category management that was issued, just before the end of the previous administration, and comments came in and whatnot. And then the new administration put on a regulatory freeze. So presumably that best-in-class was not in place, but the government continues to identify best-in-class contracts. How is that happening?
How's that happening?
Yeah.
Has nothing to do with either administration. I'm just going to say that. Okay. So we have people in place who have bought into, from a policy standpoint, the best in class by nature. If we left the studio and went outside and did sidewalk interviews, I said, well, what do you think about the government buying best in class contracts there? Why wouldn't they say yes? I mean, it's attractive.
Sure. Absolutely.
But the key here is I'm learning a lot here today from these lawyers here. Process versus mission. That's a real good analogy there. In binary, I'm allowed to validate.
All right. Well, let Tom get the last word in this segment.
Get some credits out of this. Anyway,
I'm glad we could be educated.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. But the key here is, to your point, best in class. It's relative. It's all. It boils down to the requirements and the needs. And I think to single out the government is doing itself. It's a huge disservice by even moving forward on any type of identification that way. From my opinion, if you want to take it down to the mat and talk about this for a long time, every contract the government awards should be best in class
right.
under that
Absolutely.
Procurement period.
Yeah.
Period.
Exactly.
You know, if it didn't, why did they award
right.
it?
Right.
Yeah.
But I think you want to make clear that, all this discussion sounds like, again, in a binary context,
yes.
that you don't like category. It's not that at all. It's that you have to use category management as a tool. It should not supplant the main goal of the system, which is to fulfill the mission. If buying through a system that breaks out categories for efficient buy to legitimately avoid unreasonable duplication, yes, by all means,
sure,
do it.
Absolutely.
But to hamstring into agencies into a one-size-fits-all solution doesn't do anybody any favors, because then it's, you know, you have this, you know, let 100 flowers bloom, right? It becomes this kind of centralized, consolidated system that sustains itself.
Right. Well, thank you. We've got one more segment coming up, guys. My guests today are Bill Gormley, he's president of the Gormley Group, and Tom Sisti, he's senior director and chief legislative counsel at SAP. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about just, you know, we talked about commercial item a little bit. We can talk about commercial item contracting, what Section 801 may or may not mean, and, you know, what's the future role of the Schedules Program. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Fed News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Fed News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Tom Sisti. He is Senior Director and Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP, and Bill Gormley is President of the Gormley Group. And gentlemen, I think we beat category management to death, or at least we talked about it a lot in the last segment, right? So let's talk a little bit about, you know, the one of the things that the category manager is supposed to design to reflect is to better understand the commercial marketplace, to make better buying decisions for the government and manage that, manage the data. And we'll not even talk about data on the show, but just that access to the commercial market, the access to innovation. There's a lot of focus on that right now from a policy perspective. Tom, can you talk a little bit about, you know, why that is and what it may mean for, this is the nexus to operations, what it may mean for operations and the procurement system?
Well, I think, yeah, from a real-time standpoint, the government needs access to its day-to-day commercial items, those things that we take for granted, notepads, pens, pencils, whatever. And so focusing on a platform that expedites that without going through what are perceived to be the procedural hamstring activities that exist in greater sized procurements is viewed as being a good thing. And I think industry as a whole probably agrees with that, that the platforms, these platforms have a place. Figuring out what that place is, I think, is a bit of a challenge. You want to make sure that you understand what exists in the marketplace from the standpoint of platforms themselves. I mean, singular platforms versus spot buying platforms, for instance, that would survey a bunch of platforms that are offering the same product to see if the best deal can be obtained by the government, the transaction fees associated with that. You know, these platforms represent a commercial competitive offering of commercial items, but at the same time, they take place through a channel that may or may not be competed if it's a sole channel or it's one of a handful of channels. And then again, when you have other channels that serve as spot buying marketplaces, those in and of themselves can extend the reach, if you will, the market research reach of the government by looking at price and other factors. There are things that are attendant to them. Again, we talked earlier about the government not being exactly like the commercial market. It has data needs. Some of those platforms may also be product sellers. So to the extent that competitors are leveraging those platforms and their data transits those platforms, who owns that data? From the government standpoint, it ought to be the government's data to use and not be used by anyone who provides that platform service. The government has operational security needs. If you think about it, in the government, these things, you say, well, who cares about commercial items? Well, if they're fundamental items like water, toilet paper, and there are massive shipments going to a region of the world, that kind of information might be of value to some of the people in that corner of the world, especially given current events. You know, there used to be, I don't know if it was a true story, but the lore surrounding You knew DOD was going to do something by the number of pizza deliveries to the Pentagon. You know,
right,
I don't know if
sure.
That's true, but it's that concept, the idea of taking the mosaic pieces of information and putting them together and getting a picture. So, you know, how data is controlled, secured, safeguarded, who owns it, how it is let out, that's a critical issue for any of these platforms. The government's capacity to manage the fundamental aspects of law. You've got to have some kind of term or condition in these. It can't be just an open marketplace, people to click and buy. Who's going to audit whether you have counterfeit issues, trade agreements compliance, Buy American compliance, small business compliance? You have to have those mechanisms in place through the contracting process. And then you have to say, are we drawing artificial distinctions with some of these platforms? You know, the schedules is a commercial buying platform as
just
well.
Just managed by GSA.
Right. So you have that. You have FedMall. These platforms are set up with the understanding of the government buyer. To what extent are you hindering those platforms by not allowing them to operate as you would other platforms that exist that or could exist? So, I mean, you have a whole bunch of issues that that come into play here, including what this does to the market itself. You're not talking about a single entity that is controlling the transaction of a pen going through the market. It's sort of a single or handful of entities controlling everything. And it may be on the scale of the government, but that's a pretty big scale. And you have to make sure there isn't some inappropriate interplay that affects the commercial market writ large.
Right. So, you know, just all those are really fascinating issues to play out. We could do a whole show on each one of those. But just listening to Tom's description, one of the things that sort of stuck on me, I want to ask you from an operational perspective. Well, when you think about commercial platforms or whatever those may or may not be, you know, I started to think about it when you're talking about it as, when Tom was talking about it, as, you know, we talked earlier about multiple word contracts and that you've got to have flexibility. It's a tool in the toolbox. There's multiple tools in the toolbox. Aren't we going to end up approaching these commercial platforms, whatever they may be, from the same perspective? So there may be spot buying commercial platforms. There may be platforms that are single logistics support of a particular entity. It's in the government's interest to have multiple alternative platforms or capabilities across the board, whether and even, you know, like addressing, fixing GSA Advantage or eBuy or whatever, or FedMall, to address that is, you know, because the government is such a big place that it's in its interest to have multiple sort of platforms and, you know, not too many, right? Because we don't get to over-duplicate things, but there is, it's not binary. It's not one versus a thousand. There's some management point where that flexibility makes sense. Does that make sense, Bill? Or what are your thoughts on that? You're the operations guy.
Well, you know, there's the old term, no free lunch. There's no free e-commerce. Okay, so I think this is not, there is no cure-all. There's not a cure-all for a lot of things, and there's no one single cure-all for government procurement by e-commerce is a host of logistics and data collection, and because what that's hooked up to all of the same sources that the schedules programs are hooked up to. So if you think about it, the schedules, the program, to you brought it up, is the largest, you know, commercial avenue to or access to the commercial sector, the schedules. So if you could just bear with me a second, visualize this for me. You know, I'm not asking you to respond to it. If you overlaid the FAR onto an e-commerce platform.
Okay.
Now, do we think that's going to speed up, or we think, you know, there's a lot. You overlay that in the socioeconomic right. aspect of this thing and specific government agency policies or initiatives aside the FAR. You start put an umbrella term with the FAR over e-commerce. The E is not going to be very exciting, all right? And so that's where the commerce sector. The commerce is pretty much business transactions. So it would have a hard time of knowing where in the hell all the finance offices are in government. I'm not being critical of either side here. There's a lot that goes into this, and Tom touched on part of it, just pure security reasons. And so to say we're just going to jump in on it, and I get it, because you got to do some things, change elements. Sometimes it's got to go through the shock of it, and that's healthy. There's nothing wrong with it. But I think the expectation of how does government get better and getting what it needs and smarter, and I hate to use the word cheaper, just better, because value plays sure. into this. You know, and so, you know, someone told me the other day, Bill, you should never buy a new car. I'm like, I'm not really interested in it, but why should I buy a new car? He said, you should never buy a new car. It's pretty interesting. So you touched on something a minute ago, made me think about it. I'm like, why? He says, because the technology is changing so rapidly. Keeping a car 10 years from now, you know, your car is going to be the one at the end of the lot as far as trade-in value, because the technology will have far. It's just kind of the whole. So that, like, God dang it, man. Now you're going to have everybody on your show probably going to lease a car. But the point was, it was intriguing, like, where they holding the whole thing. So just with that scenario and what government's trying to do in a macro sense is pretty significant. And the e-commerce is a good tool. The government has e-commerce. Okay, is it perfect? No. I mean, no, let's not even try to make it.
Right.
But you overlay the FAR on something, and that's still, that should be a requirement.
But, you know, there is a concern that just as you were speaking came up, and that is, you know, people will say, well, maybe we don't need these processes. Let's peel away these processes. There's a danger, I think, in determining whether a process applies based on a buying channel. If you go back to commercial items, and this was a long debate, commercial items were given streamlined rule applicability. Why? Not because you were buying them a certain way. You bought them a certain way because of
their, they were a certain thing.
That's right. They, as commercial items, they had the test of competition, so the government's price risk was lower, and you didn't need something like TINA.
Right.
Audits. It had competitive pressure that was promoting innovation over time. So the government didn't have to worry about design speccing. That's a far cry from saying, okay, we're buying something a certain way. Let's waive process.
Right.
The way you buy may inspire more process because of the nature of the marketplace. So I think these things have to be talked through. Again, along with this theme of binary, this isn't a binary statement for or against. It's really a statement that you have to look at the parts of this buying system to make sure you're doing the right thing, all focused on what? Meeting the mission needs of the agency.
That's
it. We're
done, man. We're way done. Okay.
Let's talk pricing next time on schedules.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So I want to thank my guest today, Tom Sisti. He is Senior Director and Chief Legislative Counsel at SAP, and Bill Gormley, he's President of the Gormley Group. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.